Astronomy and Space with David Rennick.
Always enjoy having a chat with this man. Hello, David Rennicky. How are you?
Yeah, good to be with you again, Brent.
You good? You well?
Yeah, good day. Yeah, the weather's fine.
Yeah, excellent.
And I'm all mooned out.
You're all mooned. I bet you are, yeah. We talked a lot about the moon, didn't we, with the 50th anniversary?
Thank God it's only every 50 years.
I
enjoyed it because it gave us a chance to introduce one of the greatest events in human history to people who weren't alive at the time. And I think I said to you before, it's funny, isn't it? 60% of the population weren't around then.
Yeah, for my business on social media on the Sunday, I tweeted that figure that 60% weren't around, and in another 50 years it'll almost be 100% won't be around, won't it?
Well, I hope you'll be around to talk about it.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk first about solar. The headline says solar sailing satellite.
Yeah.
It's a tongue twister. Solar sailing satellite proves it can use light to propel through space. We have a solar sailing satellite. What's this all about?
Yeah, this is a new concept by a group called the Planetary Society from California. Now, they've been around a long time. These are people, Brent, who work in future concepts on ways to reach the stars. The idea is to have a sail in space made of a material pretty much like mylar, a sail that would be extended like a sailboat would on the water. And as a sailboat picks up the wind to push it along, this extended sail could be up to a kilometre wide, even bigger, is pushed along by photons, energy from the sun.
Right.
They take a long time to get up to speed, but when they do, they can get up to pretty high speed. They can travel as far as you want, as long as you've got energy from something like the sun pushing it. Now, at this stage, it's really confined to our solar system, but it's a way in future of having a fuel-less vehicle, if you will, with sensors on it, equipment on it, to reach the outer extremities of the solar system for one very small fraction of the cost. Bill Nye is the guy who's putting it together. It is now in space, and it's being the shakedown test being done. It's around 800-900K above us. It's fairly high. It's only a little guy at the moment, but the sail has been extended, and they will look and see how this goes over a period of time. Whether the material can stand it for the rigors of space, we don't know. It's just an idea whose time has probably come.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to really stretch a long bow, one of these eventually may sail to another solar system somewhere else.
So it's basically that's what they're setting out to prove, that this big sail will propel space craft without needing to have engines and things like that.
Yeah, that's the idea. The Japanese have been right into this for quite some time now. This mission here called Light Sail 2 has only been a $7 million venture. It's not an expensive job. And it's a lot of trial and error. Previous ones didn't work out all that well because they were too tiny, too close. This one's a little bit further out. This is going to do us for a while. We'll be able to look at this in a few years' time and determine whether it's worthwhile pushing. I think a light sail, to me, honestly, is realistically, it's got limitations. It can't really, you can't see a concept of a sail pushing itself along out past Pluto. Because if you're on Pluto right now looking back at us here, you wouldn't see the Earth at all. You would see the sun as a very bright star, and that's about all.
Right.
So it's just a way of moving stuff around. I think in the future we'll see these things working, but they'll be interplanetary within our planetary system here, and moving cargo, maybe people, who knows, from one place to another. I think we're looking at an alternative, cheap way of doing it rather than blasting things in rockets. You know.
Speaking of the moon and the sun, when they stood on the moon, we have some magnificent pictures of Earth from the moon.
Yeah.
What would they be able to look at the sun?
Yeah, now that's interesting. You know, look, one of the criticisms of the moon landing was there are two shadows in the photos. Have you heard that?
I have.
There should be. If there wasn't, you can say it was faked. Because there's sunlight from one side hitting you, and there's reflected Earth light from the other. Now, Aldrin said to me, I asked him about that, and he said, we had to put our Polaroid visors down all the time we were on the moon in the sunlit side, where the temperature got up to 180 degrees, by the way. And he said, we needed our visor there because it was so bright. He said, we saw the Earth in one corner of the sky and the sun in the other. And that's why you've got two shadows. He said, if you think full moon's pretty bright from here, full Earth is four times brighter.
Gosh.
So you can understand the Earth being a bigger target, four times bigger, is going to reflect back a lot more light. And more so because we've got a lot of oceans there.
Would you see the Earth from Mars?
You'd only see it as a tiny blue, well, not tiny, but a reasonably, well, not big, but as we would see Jupiter now, if you've ever looked at Jupiter through a telescope, you can see it clearly. Yes, you would. You would see a bluey-green planet. You wouldn't be able to make out much detail on it, but if you had a high-power telescope on Mars, the best you could probably see, Brent, would be the clouds we've got, you know, and you may even make out the continent structure itself. From the moon, you can't see any detail. They can see continents, and they told me, you know, Aldrin said, when we looked at the Earth from a distance, it was green and brown. Where the Earth was, that was the browny colour. And he said the greeny-blue was actually the oceans itself. You can see the clouds quite clearly, but you couldn't make out any detail. And it's a complete untruth that you can't see the wall of China or anything like that. You can from the space station quite clearly. In fact, from the space station, they can see ships in the ocean.
Is that true?
They're not all that high. But on the moon, you can only see the Earth. But what a beautiful sight. I remember Gene Cernan saying to me, when I turned around and looked at it, he said to me, and I remember these words clearly, the last man on the moon, he said, Dave, all I wanted to do is put my hand in my pocket and pull a camera out and take a last photograph so I could show everybody at home how beautiful it was. He said, I didn't have one with me. He said, but that's what I wanted to do most of all.
I got a few emails at the time that we spoke about the 50-year anniversary, and there were lots of statistics that people didn't know being bandied around. One of them was that when they finally did land on the moon, they had 25 seconds of fuel left. 17 seconds of fuel left.
Yeah.
I had a couple of emails asking, well, if that be the case, if they only had 17 seconds of fuel left, how did they get off?
No, that was the reserve fuel they had. Like when you're driving along your car, your little light flickers on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that tells you you've got a little bit more left. You can still go a little bit further, but when you run out, that's when it's a danger point. This was only the reserve fuel. This is their landing fuel. They only had 17 seconds left of their landing fuel. There was enough fuel in the vehicle to get them off the moon. That was still there in the other tank. But this tank, if you imagine two tanks, your landing tank and your coming home tank, the landing tank was the one we're talking about. The amount of fuel they had in that vehicle as they were landing on the moon, if they'd have gone any further than 17 seconds, they'd be cutting into their return journey fuel, and there may not be enough there to get off the moon. They could, but they probably wouldn't be able to dock with the command module.
Speaking of the moon, the other story is Pakistan's citizens. What do they think of this Indian lunar mission? Because the Indians had two goes. They were successful on their second launch, weren't they, to go to the dark side of the moon.
Yep. They're doing well. At the moment, they've already got their vehicle on the way. It's a 47-day journey. I don't know why they're taking so long, but they're obviously shaking this vehicle down. It is launch called Chandrayaan 2, and Chandrayaan means moon vehicle in Sanskrit. They're heading for the South Pole here, Brent. What they're going to do here is to arrive late September and orbit the moon around the South Pole and drop a lander down there. Now, this lander is going to do two things. It's going to scout out a reservoir of water for a future base that they can put there, and they're looking at a landing spot for, I guess, for their astronauts, whatever they call them there, for a future visit. The Chinese are there at the same time. They're on the other side of the moon. Remember, we talked about that. They're on the other side. No matter where you look on the moon, there's only one place that we can go to, and that is the South Pole. They all know that. Bezos, Elon Musk, NASA, this is where everybody will go to. You're going to see a plethora of spacecraft here, private and ones run by national agencies, because that's where the water is trapped in the craters down there, in a place called the Aitken Basin. It is absolutely massive. There is so much water there trapped. Now, we can use that for washing and creating rocket fuel from an extension base. This is where a first base will be put. And I'm sure that, you know, when you think about this, here's India. What an impoverished country.
Mm.
A country that has got so many social problems and so overpopulated, yet they have one of the strongest space programs ever. They're actually number four next to the Europeans and NASA and of course, the Russians, you know. So they're doing quite well. I wish them well. They've had a few dud runs. They're doing this on a budget, of course, but look, top marks to them. They'll get there and they'll put their base up and they'll be like everybody else. They'll be getting minerals and God knows what else in the 2020s.
David, in the future, when this happens, what's going to be the rules and regulations of who owns what in reference to land areas on the moon?
Who owns what? Yeah, that's the problem at the moment. It hasn't been ratified. This is an issue that really needs to be looked at, and it is being looked at now. And it's going to have to be drafted through the United Nations, as the 1967 treaty was. It was obvious in the early 60s that America were going to the moon. Now, the other nations, like Russia mainly, said, you know, we want to make sure you guys don't go and grubstake this place. You can't put your flag there and say you own it. They weren't intending to do that anyway, but this was the fear that they had. So the United Nations put a treaty forward called the 1967 Outer Space Treaty. It only mentioned countries have no sovereignty or no sovereign rights on any celestial real estate. It left out individuals. This is where a man named Dennis Hope came in. He's the one currently selling 1 acre on the moon for $29.95. But the only law we have is an antiquated one from 1967. There are lawyers in America now and in Europe drafting what's called space law. We're going to need to have some sort of jurisdiction, some sort of ruling. And you're right, you know, this is needed now, because at this stage, anybody can go to the moon and pick up all of those artifacts, bring them back, and there's no claim on them. There's nothing to say they can't do that. They're priceless. Some of those things would be priceless.
You talk about the water on the moon. Do we know how clear that water is? I mean, is it potable water?
Yeah, it is ice. Don't matter if it's not clear, we can always purify it.
Right.
You can do that quite easily with water. We're doing it all the time on the space station. It is ice in every sense of the word. And the reason we've got ice there is because over millions and millions of years, the moon was pummeled by comets, huge comets, some of them hundreds of kilometers in diameter. And comets are really dirty snowballs, Brent. When you think of a comet, think of an asteroid with ice packed around the outside. You know, you get a snowball.
Yeah.
Imagine getting a rock and putting a snow around it, down the snowy.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a rock and you put snow around it, that's what a comet is. Now, comets hitting the moon over a period of time deposited this water everywhere. But, of course, near the equator, it would have boiled away. But down in the bottom part of the moon and the top moon part of the moon as well, there are craters there that are actually hundreds of meters deep. And this is where the ice has been. It's been sitting there all this time in conditions close to minus 200 degrees. So it's there. It just needs to be ice. We'll get it out and thaw it out and purify it for drinking. I mean, it's ready to go. You can't have a base anywhere on Mars, on any of the other planets, any moons, and especially on the moon. You can't have it without water. And that's what it's all about. That's when we look for planets around other stars at the moment, we look for two things. We look for position, away from its star, not too hot, not too cold, and the fact that it could have or must have running water.
I suppose a bit like buying a house, isn't it? Position, yeah. Position.
Location, location, location.
Exactly right. It's always wonderful to catch up with you, David Renicki. Thanks for your time this afternoon.
Thanks, Brett.
We'll talk again soon.
Will do. Bye.
Thanks, mate. Bye-bye. That's David Renicki, our astronomer mate. He's got a website. Just Google David Renicki and you'll get his website. You can join. It's all free. And he sends you out all these, if you're into space and all the things that go with it, he'll send you out a newsletter free.